Good space time, y'all. In this episode of the Citizen Cosmos podcast, I speak to Jaya Clara Breck, Chief Strategy Officer at NIM Project, a privacy platform working on infrastructure at the network and application layers. Along with Jaya, we discuss decentralization and its origins, trust, networking, privacy as a fundamental right, and who needs saving. We also talked about semantic corruption, criminal activity, pain as a catalyst for change, and drone strikes.
Was super curious about the totally crazy mix of people that was in this hall. It was everything from dreadlocked anarchists to, you know, people in the financial sector, all the way through to kind of devs and hackers.
The blockchain industry doesn't need saving. It's the greediness in the people.
You look at some of the texts from the 80s and 90s, and they're talking about how this infrastructure is going to turn into a vehicle for mass surveillance. And that's pretty much exactly what happened.
Bridging ecosystems with bridges isn't enough. You have to bridge communities as well.
Equality means everybody should have the same rights despite being completely different. That's the promise of political decentralization. There is no technical infrastructure without humans.
Before we rock it off into today's podcast, here is a roundup of the latest news from the sponsor of this episode, Cyber. The Cyber Congress DAO has been primarily working on improving the Bostrom Hub. This work includes testing of the contracts, new UI features, verification tools for on-chain governance, and polishing the Bostrom DEX, adding MEV protection, new web front, and bringing indexing of chain swaps. To try Bostrom, head now to oversib.ai.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Citizen Cosmos podcast. And today I have Jaya from the NIM Project with me. Jaya, hi.
Hello. It's very good to be here.
Yes, it's nice to see you. We've been trying to get NIM for a while, actually. And the podcast is going to be about you, of course. But I have some questions about NIM as well. And because NIM has been a little bit in the background, no?
Yeah, it has. I'm happy to give the full explanation for why, but we're very happy to kind of come out and be a lot more public. But yeah, let's get into that.
Coming out is good.
Coming out is good.
Let's take it easy, though. So first thing is first, I would like, of course, I didn't introduce you properly. I would like you to introduce yourself. Tell us everything that you do, anything about yourself, anything you want us to know.
Yeah, so my name is Jaya, and I am the head of strategy at NIM. That's a kind of very fancy title for saying that I work with connecting the kind of deep work that's being done on the tech level to everything that happens externally in the world, right? So whether that has to do with understanding, you know, why privacy is relevant in terms of current affairs, or why privacy is relevant for specific events that are happening in the industry, or kind of tying it to people's personal experiences of navigating digital, our digital lives today, that's kind of my role. So it kind of spans everything from narrative to marketing to communications, and figuring out kind of how to make sense of the NIM project within a kind of broader ecosystem and a broader context. What else can I say about myself? I guess my profile is a little bit, for some time, I've had a foot in a few different industries. So actually came into the whole blockchain space quite a few years ago. I think I initially read the Bitcoin white paper maybe already in 2013 or 2012, and ended up writing a PhD, which was a political analysis of the Bitcoin protocol and the Ethereum protocol. So when I wrote the PhD, it was kind of right at the early days of Ethereum. I think I went to the first Ethereum DevCon in the city of London. Was super curious about the totally crazy mix of people that was in this hall. It was everything from dreadlocked anarchists to, you know, people in the financial sector, all the way through to kind of devs and hackers. So, you know, that kind of got me interested in, and hooked immediately. But generally, my profile has also always been as a someone that sits in between the kind of crypto skeptics and the rest of the industry. So I'm a little bit of a crypto skeptic. I think that the industry needs a lot of healthy criticism and healthy skepticism. But I'm also always looking for how to make sense of this in a kind of generous way. So how to kind of understand what are actually the possibilities of this technology, and where does it make sense in terms of use cases and so on to build the types of distributed and decentralized systems that we're building today. Yeah, I think that's kind of good enough as an introduction for now.
It's amazing. But I want to calm you down straight away, because you said your title, you know, and sounds fancy. Mine is Chief Manager of Looking Busy. So that is a lot fancier than anybody's
absolutely.
Title. So
absolutely.
It's like, damn. Bitcoin white paper, I have a question. You said you read it in 2012-13, a little bit around the same time I did. I did a little bit earlier even, but it took me 3 years to understand it. Did you understand everything it was in there straight away, and it just made sense to you?
No, I mean, it took me quite a few years to understand as well. But I think understanding the Bitcoin white paper is, I guess one thing that I've always found fascinating is, like, for me, the Bitcoin white paper, I see it as a piece of incredible literature, right? So it's incredible storytelling, just a few pages that just gives a kind of certain narrative and perspective on the world, which, you know, many parts of which I actually disagree with, you know, the kind of analysis of how the world operates. But as a piece of storytelling, I find it to be absolutely incredible, absolutely baffling. So for me, it was, and that took a little while to realize. The reason why it kind of got me interested was because before reading this, I was involved in a lot of political movements and activist movements that were heavily decentralized. And, you know, I came from a kind of generation that was super into, you know, the Pirate Bay and BitTorrent. So our versions of decentralization were kind of quite explicitly anti-capitalist. And they were kind of quite explicitly like post-scarcity ideas around the digital world. And then like seeing kind of a lot of the technologies that I was kind of used to from that background being kind of repositioned as something that can construct digital scarcity was something that I was like, okay, wow, this is a totally different turn on things that I think I'm not happy about. But on the other hand, it's opening up all these new possibilities. And a lot of my friends got involved that were involved in like alternative currency movements and started to play around immediately, right? They're like, great, we can bring, you know, social currencies and alternative currencies to the internet by making use of this new kind of technological advancement. So it was kind of this weird twist of things where it's like some part of me was quite critical of this new turn on the agenda for decentralization, but part of me was also super fascinated by all the new possibilities that came out of it, right? And I'm still very much in that state. That kind of describes me still today.
This is very cool because you don't meet many people who are, let's say, I don't like the word OG, but okay, let's go with it. I hate those terms like OG tokenomics. I'm sorry. It doesn't click with my internal being. I do use them, but anyways, I mean, it has a level of understanding. That's the second thing, which is obviously at the highest point and is skeptical for so long. It's good. I like it because it's not very often that you meet somebody who can do constructive criticism. It reminded me a little bit of, you remember George Carlin for sure?
Yeah.
The comedian?
Yeah.
And he had a sketch on Save the Planet. I think it was called Save the Planet. And I think his main point was like, the planet doesn't need saving. It's the people, right, that need fixing. Yeah. It's like the blockchain industry doesn't need saving. It's the greediness in the people. That's what I'm trying to get at. And you mentioned the possibilities I think it creates. And one thing it didn't or did create the effect of, a lot of people presumed it was private and still do. And it didn't really did that. Is that one of the reasons why you're still skeptical? Because privacy is such an important concern, or other reasons?
Yeah. I mean, there's other reasons too. I think like a lot of the core promises, so like both, yes, privacy, absolutely. Also decentralization and also the idea of trust. So in the early days, there was this idea that we can solve the problem of trust, whether it has to do with money or with the law or with politics or whatever else, by creating these decentralized trustless systems, right? And over and again, we see that actually the idea of a trustless system just never quite plays out that way in reality. And people, in fact, have to trust a lot of different aspects of the architecture, which then leads to the possibilities for new types of scams and so on and so forth. And so the kind of gap between the like promise of a kind of trustless architecture that can solve the problem of politics, the problem of economics via technology, you know, through technological infrastructure, you know, that promise kind of keeps being broken. And I think this year it's been a kind of real, a wake up call for people, right? There's only so much that people can take before it's like, well, you know, come on, man. And of course we can get into, you know, the fact that like FTX wasn't truly decentralized, blah, 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 this and that. But the fact remains that like an industry that kind of prides itself on making these types of promises around trust, around decentralization and around privacy, at some point has to kind of live up to them. So yeah, that is the kind of the continued criticism. And when it comes to privacy, I think it's like, it's one of those things that like was, you know, it's been around since, you know, as a kind of core principle and pillar of the industry since the very beginning. And I would argue even before that, because if you look at the kind of technological history of blockchain and of Bitcoin, it of course ties back into the whole kind of cypherpunk history where privacy was really core part of the cypherpunk analysis of how the internet was likely to play out. And unfortunately, they were correct, right? You look at some of the texts from the 80s and 90s, and they're talking about how this infrastructure is going to turn into a vehicle for mass surveillance. And that's pretty much exactly what happened. So, you know, that's why I'm working with NIM today, not just to correct an error of the past, but also because I actually think that privacy is one of those topics that strikes at the heart of a lot of the problems that we see in the internet today. And so I think it's not just solving a problem of the past, but it's really laying the foundation for a radically different future and a radically different set of possibilities for online life and how online life might look like.
I think it's astonishingly ironic that in industry, which one of the biggest labels is trustless, the biggest mistake that we do is trust people to do something. It's like, wait a second, the whole idea was not to trust these guys. The irony is there.
But I just want to make one correction, which usually gets lost here. People love to say, like, it's the problem of the human, right? People love to say, like, oh, we continue to trust humans when we should, it's the trustless infrastructure, that's the point. But that keeps obscuring the fact that there is no technical infrastructure without humans, right? So this idea that we can solve all the problems through a technological solution is also a bit of a problem, right? So there's something else that's missing here. It's always going to be a combination of people and code, right? Not just people or code. Because the problem of trust, we saw that with a DAO hack, right? In Ethereum initially, right? It's like, okay, you don't just write a bit of code and then it's neutral and then it's perfect. It's like, no, that code needs to be corrected all the time. Because there's hacks, there's errors, this and that. So
I was actually going to say, in a way, a little bit into the same direction. I was going to say my, not the actual tag name, but, you know, like on Twitter, you can put also the description. And the username has been decentralization for about 5 or 6 years now, I think. So, like, I totally on the same line here with you. It's interesting. But you know what? I have since, obviously, you have been in this movement for a while. And a question I have for you might seem strange for you, but this is, well, it might seem too simple for you. But this is something I really like to get to the bottom of with guests who really are, you can see that it's their values. What is decentralization for you? But I don't want a textbook example. I want like your own. What does it mean for you? Is it a spectrum? Do we need to achieve decentralization? Is decentralization a must? What is decentralization? How is it going to help people? Like a lot of things there.
There is a lot of things. And you've actually touched on a super interesting question. And you've also asked me something that I'm kind of doing a bit of soul searching about right now. Because there is this tendency to conflate a lot of different ideas of decentralization, right? So to my mind, there's actually a very big difference between technological infrastructural decentralization, i.e. a decentralized network, and decentralized network routing from how we understand Paul Baran's original diagrams of the internet and so on. Big difference between that and then when we're talking about political decentralization or decentralized decision-making amongst human beings, right? And I think the fact that people conflate these things causes a lot of confusion. And one of the big confusions that it causes is, you know, you look at Paul Baran's like network routing, in essence, all the nodes need to be the same because like you need kind of fault tolerance. So some networks get knocked out, some nodes get knocked out. You still need the networks to kind of operate as intended. So all the nodes look the same. It's a kind of horizontal network of equally shaped nodes operations, this and that, in order to route packets effectively through this thing, right? When it comes to human beings and it comes to the way that politics operates, it's almost the opposite of that. No human being is the same. People are not equal in their capacities. And the purpose of decentralization is exactly to deal with that fact, right? It's exactly to ensure that there is some kind of representation of all these different voices and these differences. And it's not to equalize everybody and turn everybody into the same. And I think this is a big misunderstanding when it comes to political decentralization. It's almost as if like decentralized infrastructural understandings has kind of reshaped our minds. And we now think that, you know, like in order for people to be equal, everybody has to be the same. Like actually, equality means the opposite. Equality means everybody should have the same rights despite being completely different, despite being radically different, right? That's the promise of political decentralization. But so for me, this is kind of the important thing around the word decentralization is to start to make some distinctions between whether we mean technical decentralization, whether we mean political decentralization, decentralized decision-making in terms of management and kind of a cybernetic understanding or what, right? And we have to start to be specific because there's a lot of damage that happens when we start to assume that political decentralization has to mean everybody operates and speaks the same and thinks the same because that's political violence right there. And in fact, it should do the opposite.
I think politics in itself is kind of presuming violence, like the rule over another person or the rule over somebody's opinion already automatically kind of presumes some use of violence, no?
So it depends how you understand the word politics, right? If you understand the word politics as automatically meaning authoritarianism, then yes. But in fact, the word politics, really all it means is the negotiation of incompatible differences, right? So politics is what happens when people have to negotiate certain things that where someone is likely to lose out, right? So we need to start having a debate. Okay, if we go this direction, this person might not gain as much as if we go this direction, you know, and then you have to have a negotiation. So that's all politics really means. And then the form of how that politics takes place is, you know, it can be authoritarian, democratic, decentralized, centralized, whatever else.
I love it. I'm going to carry on being devil's advocate here. I'm going to go with your analogy. So if politics is negotiation, considering it's not a brainer that we are social creatures, we are social mammals, to be more specific. Now, if we look at nature, social mammals don't negotiate very well. They negotiate with the use of power all the time. The stronger one always wins. So doesn't that mean that negotiation would be violence any all the time, and we're not capable of doing that?
I think you should watch more nature programs. So apart from animals killing each other, you also have animals like different colored feathers, you know, birds that do a little dance, right? You've got like, I don't know, monkeys grooming each other. So,
but it's showing off something better than the other. It's showing off, like, even in nature, whether it's plant or monkey or doesn't matter, as regards to trees, for sure. I mean, they compete for light without even, but I'm not talking about trees. I'm talking about monkeys now and birds, and you're saying feathers. But again, like, I'm being devil's advocate. I'm just curious, to what extent is a human being capable with his programmed mammalism, I'm going to call it, animality, so to speak, and he's on the other end of the scales, our social capabilities that arouse us, our logical capabilities. Are we capable enough to use those to overcome that binary yes or no flight or fight decision or no? That's the question I'm kind of getting at.
I think we do that all the time. It's just that people tend to focus on, you know, the fight or flight and tend to focus on the extreme competitive and violent examples because those are the ones that hurt, right? So those are the ones that grab our attention. And then we tend to ignore all the everyday stuff where we never resort to those things, where it has much more to do with, you know, do you have a crush on that person? You know, are you in love with that person? Do you feel sorry for this person? We have such a kind of like breadth of feelings that and ways of empathizing and ways of negotiating our social relationships that actually are the norm. The kind of hardcore competitive and violent experiences and approaches tend to be the exception, but we tend to focus a lot on those because those are the ones that are more spectacular. Those are the ones that demand an immediate response because they create a shock factor and because they put us into the fight or flight mode. And I think because those are the ones that hurt the most. And when something really hurts, then you remember it. All the bits of kind of pleasure, boredom, experiences that happen in between, it's easy to gloss over those. But I think if we paid more attention to those, we can see that humans have a huge breadth and capacity for other ways of living together that tend to function as a norm. And in fact, trees don't compete. Well, trees, they might compete for light sometimes, but they also use mycelium networks exactly to feed each other if another tree is sick, right? So there's plenty of examples.
Absolutely, yeah. They do. Absolutely. For sure, there's like other whales raising whales to the top of the thing to breathe water if they cannot, you know. So there's many examples of animals helping
exactly.
each other out. I'm just trying to think, are we capable of being the whale who lifts the other whale up? Or are we kind of the white shark that feeds on a seal always and always?
No, I think we are different things in different moments, right? I certainly am, right? Sometimes I'm the shark and sometimes I'm like the butterfly, you know, it really depends. But I'm not the kind of person that kind of wants to appeal to people's goodwill and kind of like hippie vibes to wish for a better world and some kind of abstract future. I actually think that in many ways, the circumstances that we're heading into as humanity is going to force us into that mode of operating. So this is not a kind of choice of luxury. This is not a kind of fluffy choice of kind of morality or ethics necessarily. It's a realpolitik almost, a new type of realpolitik where it's like, when you're faced with climate crises, you're faced with economic crises, you're basically faced with crises that are far beyond the individual and without cooperation and without understanding for the conditions of other people, including animal life and plant life, we simply cannot survive. So it's not like a kind of fluffy, I hope everybody's a good person type vibe. It's like step up, right? It's like step up or die kind of vibe. Yeah.
Well, decentralization is responsibility, first of all, right? People don't want responsibility. I mean, you mentioned, interestingly, you mentioned pain, and a lot of experiences pain, and a lot of, sorry, cases, pain means experience. I mean, I remember they had this interesting study on one of the Tibetan monks who voluntarily, the one with the Zen meditation, I think he recently died a few years ago. If I'm not mistaken, I might be mistaken. I hope I didn't just bury a live person. But I remember they connected like a lot of wires to his brain, and they realized that he can actually literally, about the flight or fight mode, he was literally able to attack his own amygdala kind of thing with happiness, and because of the way of his knowledge in meditation, he would actually change completely. The neurotransmitters work, and it was fascinating. They were like, what the hell? How does it mean possible? So humans are definitely capable of great and good things. It's just a matter of, I think, I don't know. It's like, that's what I'm trying to understand from you. Like, how do you see us, you know, getting there? I mean, if blockchain technology is, which was one of the most promising things, or is one of the most promising trustless technologies for a long time, you know, even though it's nothing new, it's just the right bits and bobs put together in the right order kind of thing. But if that's also not going to help us, what's going to help us then? Well, what are we to do, like, to get to that state you're describing?
Well, you know, nothing's going to save us. But a lot of interesting things will happen along the way.
Oh, well.
I
was just going to say before you started, if you remember Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, when the beginning, when there was like, are we all going to die? Shall we put some, you know, tinfoil paper over our heads? I was like, you can if you want. You know, I'm not going to help you.
Exactly.
Sorry, go on. I'm apologizing.
Exactly. And it's the same with the blockchain. Blockchain is like a tinfoil hat. It's like not going to save anybody. But it can do interesting things along the way. So coming back to this kind of point about pain, I think there is a tendency for people to really want to find an answer exactly as a reaction to pain, right? To painful experiences, either in their own lives or in terms of how they understand, you know, the state of the world today, right? There is this kind of immediate reaction to like try and solve it. And it's like, when are we going to, yeah, let's solve it and kind of let's arrive at a kind of final state, right? So people hope that they can solve the problem so that we can finally be free of all our problems. Or people think that there's kind of like an end moment where it's like we end up in dystopia or we end up in utopia. But I think it's time to kind of grow up a little bit and realize that there is no end state, right? We're continuing along a path and there's lessons to learn along that way. And with each step we take, there's new lessons to learn. And it's kind of as simple as that. So when it comes to ways of dealing with pain, with traumatic events at the individual level or in the actual industry, right, which I think is relevant to talk about too, in the, you know, in the blockchain industry, it's important to not end up in the fight or flight mode that looks for a final solution and that looks for a final state of being. It's like, no. Let's carefully analyze what's happened and, you know, take the next step. And it's as simple as that, really. But that does require calming down that kind of fight or flight reaction and reactivity to something that can be a little bit more considered and something that's a little bit kind of wider in scope and less trying to solve the whole world's problem in one go. Because what usually happens then is that you create your own version in your own head about what the world's problem really looks like. And then, you know, you end up with this kind of like, you try and roll out some blanket solution across all kinds of people and places that are like, oh, it's not relevant to them at best. And at worst, it's actually damaging to them because like they really didn't have that problem to start out with. So it's important to kind of calm down the ego, you know, both on the level of humanity and on the individual level and be a little bit more, okay, you know, it's not a grand narrative where we end up in heaven or hell. It's a kind of step-by-step process where we're working out some really interesting shit in the meantime. And if we pay attention, we can realize just how interesting that shit is.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think the spectrum of things and life, what you're saying reminds me actually of, I don't remember to which school of religion it belongs, or which school of thought, but it's a Japanese thing about perfection. And the whole idea was that they were trying to explain why stress is such a big problem since ever. And why do we always stress? It's because, well, we always think of perfection, but perfection doesn't exist. This is just a word, you know, there is just something, and perfection exists for one state of second. In the next second, you're already not in that state. You cannot achieve what happened like a second before in your head. So it's a never-endless game of cat and mouse. So yeah, Jaya, let's slowly move to privacy. I can see that both of us can probably go on for this decentralization thing for a long time. But I still want to ask you as well about privacy, of course, and about NIM. And maybe before privacy, a few words about NIM. I mean, I met Harry last. I don't know if he will remember me, but we met when you were launching the first public testnet, I believe, for NIM. It was during CCC in 2019.
Great.
And I was doing a speech as well, and he was doing a speech in the same decentralization, what was it called? It was the Monero and... Oh, never mind. What was it called? But and actually, ironically, I just remembered you were talking about the first DEFCON, and I remembered that the girl who's in the picture on the first DEFCON, she was also there. I don't know if I should say her name or not because I don't think she would like that. But I did remember that as well. And they also knew each other. They also knew each other. So since then, to be honest, it's been now what, 1, 2, 3 years almost? I'm going to be... really bad. I know I shouldn't say this, but I don't know much as what's been happening with you guys.
Great.
And this is my fault, but maybe you could fill us up. And
no problem at all. Yeah, exactly. I'll give you the full story. So yeah, after CCC, this was before I joined. I joined probably about a year after that, right at the end of the last testnet. So what happened was the first public testnet was launched at CCC, like you said, about 3 years ago. We then had two other testnets, one called Finny and one called Milhon, which were, you know, just trying out the kind of different, you know, the token incentives and this and that internally. And then we finally launched the live network early last year with a live token, so the NIM token. So for those who don't know at all, what NIM is, a decentralized mixnet. And what a mixnet is, it's a kind of overlay network where internet packets get routed through several nodes that then mix those packets together. So all the traffic in the internet gets, you know, or the traffic goes through, the, gets mixed together. There's timing obfuscation. So the packets have a micro delays that make it impossible for an observer to analyze patterns of communication. So why is this important? Why is it interesting? The fact of the matter is that right now, you know, both VPNs and even Tor, for someone that's actually looking at the kind of traffic moving through the network, it's possible to trace the packets, right? So, you know, with Tor, like the packets, there's kind of slight distinction in their sizes and this and that. So, and there's no timing obfuscation. So even though it's routed through a few different hops, if you have the right kind of methods of analysis, you can still more or less trace who's speaking to who by looking also at the kind of, you know, do what's called an end-to-end correlation attack. So looking at the kind of entry and exits of the network. So what NIM does is it protects metadata, IP, and patterns of communications from any kind of surveillance. In other words, a super powerful privacy system that provides privacy at the network layer, so at the kind of one of the lowest layers of the internet, the actual packet layer as it's routed through. So that's the NIM mixnet. Now, the interesting part, of course, is that we're here and the podcast is called Citizen Cosmos. So the question is, how does this relate to the Cosmos ecosystem? And, you know, this is where I would, okay, we can talk about this step by step. Let's take it step by step. We start with a mixnet. Great. So that's the update. That's the update of NIM, the mixnet, which runs on a Cosmos blockchain.
I was just saying it wasn't the next question. I'm sorry. But please go on. I was just saying no, as in it wasn't like not to speak about it. I was just like, no, 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 it's not the next question. Like, please go on. Sorry.
Okay, okay. So basically the NIM mixnet is a tokenized mixnet. So what that means is that the mix nodes that do the work of mixing traffic and providing privacy, they get rewarded through NIM tokens. And those rewards also operate as a form of internal quality control, so a form of internal reputation system. What does that mean? That means that anybody that holds native NIM tokens can stake on mixed nodes that they see as performing a good job of providing privacy, so it's a reliable mixed node. And by staking that mixed node, it means that mixed node has good reputation, and it means that it earns higher rewards, and people who stake on there earn a share of rewards as well. So it's a tokenized mixnet. The token is a utility token that operates as a reputation system. And the token is run via a smart contract on our Cosmos blockchain, which is called Nix. So the Nix blockchain exists in the Cosmos ecosystem. This is our native chain. And what we were saying earlier in the podcast, that we've been a little bit in the closet, is basically that it feels a little bit like we haven't fully come out about the fact that we've got this basically general purpose fast finality blockchain in the Cosmos ecosystem that, you know, any developer can take advantage of. And that's something that we really want to focus a lot more on next year, because the MixNet is kind of more or less up and running now. We're optimizing it and making it kind of more user-friendly, and there's going to be a lot of integrations and stuff. We're going to push the network towards mass migration next year, but we also want to focus on the Nix blockchain and make that available for the developer community to take advantage of. So I guess the way to think of it conceptually is that the NIM MixNet is a super powerful privacy network that runs as the first application on the Nix blockchain. Now, the Nix blockchain also offers additional privacy features, and that's something that we're also going to start to get into a lot more next year. And it's something called ZK-NIMS, and that's basically anonymous credentials. So what's interesting here is that Nix validators will be able to issue anonymous credentials via the Nix chain. So they'll be kind of issuing authorities of credentials. And hopefully, you know, by kind of putting out that library, we're going to see a kind of whole new set of applications taking advantage of that, which is something I'm personally really looking forward to, because I think there is so much to still be worked out around the whole area of anonymous credentials. And I think zero knowledge proofs in general is something that's going to be, you know, super fascinating over the next year or so in the privacy space.
I have a couple of like technical questions, but just like very high level in terms of, you mentioned contracts. You guys use Cosm Wasm?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. I wasn't aware. Just for the record, Citizen Cosmos is a good name. Yeah, we are focused with in Cosmos, but we also work with Ethereum, with other ecosystems out there. I think our goal is more to centralize decentralization and help people understand that, you know, bridging ecosystems with bridges isn't enough. You have to bridge communities as well.
Yay.
And I think that's our goal kind of thing that has to be there. But back to NIM, you said the words mass migration. What did that mean? What does it refer to?
Did I say mass migration? When did I say mass migration? What, when I was explaining NIM?
Yes, you were saying that we are getting ready for migrating network mass migration in a while. And
mass adoption.
I did write it down, but
sorry.
I might have. Mass adoption. This is okay. Wow, okay.
But I like the idea of mass migration. I am actually planning a mass migration as well, which might be interesting to the listener. The mass migration is, you know, half of the industry organizing its communities on Discord, right? Which, like, from a privacy perspective is like terrible. So, you know, this is a community mass migration that I'm planning to stage next year. But that's a completely separate topic. In terms of the plans for NIM next year, when I say mass adoption, it's basically, you know, the story this past year, since we've kind of launched the live mainnet, has been very much like getting the token economics up and running, right? So one thing is like the test nets that we've had, but like there is a reason to have a token, and that can't be kind of set into gear until you have a token that has a real value, and you don't have a token with a real value until you actually have mainnet, right? So we launched mainnet earlier this year. And since then, it's been a process of kind of, let's say, educating the community of mixed node operators in how the NIM token economics actually functions, because this is a mixed net. It's not a blockchain, right? Nix is the blockchain, but NIM is the mixed net. And the token economics work just a little bit differently. So it's been a kind of year of, on the one hand, optimizing the performance of the mixed net, and we're kind of starting to reach some really good speeds now. And that's going to, I can't wait for next year. We can show you just how fast and powerful this thing can be. But also really getting people used to the token economics and used to things like delegating stake onto mixed nodes, understanding what the reputation means, using the various interfaces, looking at the mixed node explorer to understand, you know, what is a good performing mixed node, what's not. So that's kind of been very much what this year has been about. It's like putting this thing out into the world and then kind of tweaking it here and there to make sure that it's kind of really in shape. And then next year, in terms of mass adoption, it's really focusing on integrations. So the NIM MixNet is going to be something that for a lot of people is going to operate in the background of existing applications that they're already using, right? So it'll be like your usual chat apps and so on that will just run, you know, traffic via the MixNet. So we're going to be kind of rolling out a whole load of partnerships with various wallets. And basically, it's going to be wallets and chat apps to start off with. And then also kind of improving the experience of users who want to use it more as a kind of VPN service. So that's the plans for the NIM MixNet next year. And I think it's going to be super exciting to see tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of users.
So you've noticed I like playing devil's advocate. So I'm going to carry on. Tornado Cash.
Yeah, let's go.
Tornado Cash. That's it. That's
Tornado
all I have
cash.
To say.
You just dropped the bomb. It's like,
bam, Mike, like 1-0. DJ spin that shit. No, I'm joking. Come on. No, like, we have to do it.
We have to. Fine. There is a huge problem with the criminalization of privacy and privacy technology. It's part of the task of NIM and other privacy projects to really intervene in the debate that can then shape regulators and the media's way of portraying these stories, right? So to come back to like what we were talking about earlier, people like sensationalism, right? They like the pain. They like the kind of big story. And the big stories tend to be the horrible headlines, right? And so one thing that we're doing at NIM is here, we founded something called the Universal Privacy Alliance alongside Manta, Secret Network, and a whole bunch of other really good projects, electric coin companies, Zcash, Aztec, Mobile Coin. I'm probably forgetting people now because there's a lot of people that have joined the alliance. But one of the main focuses of the alliance is to intervene into this narrative, right? And to turn privacy from something where people immediately associate it with crime to something that people associate with something that's normal, something that should be available to everybody. I was on a panel earlier this year with basically a kind of law enforcement agent from the United States who was, to put it mildly, like very anti-privacy, right? And he kind of works with chain analysis and this kind of thing. And it was interesting on the panel that the moment, you know, there was something that clicked for him, the moment that me and one of the other panelists started talking about health data, right? Like in his mind, all he could think about when it came to privacy was like criminals trying to hide something. That's the only thing he thought about. And I think that's often the case, right? Is that when people think about privacy preserving communications, it's immediately about crime. But the moment we mentioned health data, all of a sudden he was like, wow, yeah, okay, I get it. I mean, maybe you should come in and talk to some of my colleagues about this. let's not go that far, but but it was an interesting moment.
They keep forgetting about cash. They keep forgetting that cash still exists, right?
Exactly.
They just don't.
Exactly. And so there's a lot of work to be done on basically a game of associations. So it's like putting out visual material, putting out sentences, narratives, memes that just like pushes people's mind in a different direction. So when they think about privacy, they think about fundamental human rights. They think about how things are supposed to be. They think about an internet that is not full of like bullshit crap. Because an internet that's purely a competition for your attention, you know, purely based on profiling and targeting, to an internet that is like, man, it's like more quiet, it's more secure, it's more sensible, it's more real because privacy is there as the default, right? It's you're not open to be a target from, you know, at every moment.
It's a very interesting point about fundamental rights. I actually had this written down to ask you because I'm going to carry on with the devil thing. That doesn't have to be a fundamental right, though, because I mean, I'm coming from the point, by the way, the speech I gave where I met Harry was about privacy and digital slavery, just so you understand. But still, I'm going to ask the question. I mean, you described the internet and the way it works, and I totally agree. I have done for Ethereum, one of the first Web3 courses several years ago. It was more than, I think, 4 years ago, and about privacy it was as well. But still, what I come across is that people are kind of happy with the internet today. They kind of like don't feel that they need to be saved. And they say, well, your subjective perception of whatever you believe in is not my subjective perception of that. And here my morals start to kind of play out because I'm thinking, well, but they need to be saved. But do they really need to be saved? They don't want to be saved. It's like, so what do we do? Like, well, what does it have to be a fundamental right end of the day or not?
So no one needs to be saved. I don't like saving people either. But I do like paying very close attention to reality and what's really happening around me, right? And try and kind of analyze reality as best I can. Also to understand the likely dynamics as they're going to play out in the future, right? And let's be honest, like solving privacy is not something that happens from one day to the next. It's a long-term project here of transformation. And again, it has to do with also like one thing is like that an individual is like, yes, I'm happy with the way the internet works today. I love it. I get fed ads about things that I really like. So this is perfect. I love giving my data away so that, you know, the algorithm can know me better, which is like, you know, fair enough. Like, I think it's important to understand for that privacy should not be something that's going to like block things, but instead opens up new possibilities. So for me, it's like, you know, there's arguments around things like, okay, imagine if the information that was fed to an algorithm was even more sensible and you had a little bit more choice in the matter about, you know, what you get fed and when and in what kind of scenario. So it's like, has more to do with the ability to exercise some control, than like blocking and shutting down everything that exists right now. The other point that I wanted to make is that I think the kind of the consequences of the lack of privacy is only slowly dawning on people, right? So like with the Edward Snowden revelations, it was very much like, oh, outrage, you know, and a few people kind of felt it to be kind of outrageous, but it was like at this very abstract kind of like meta, like societal level, right? Where it very easily becomes a kind of question of morality and whatever else. But the consequences of what Snowden revealed then are still playing out. Like we're still kind of getting to know those consequences. And some of those are more violent than others, right? So some relate to directly to drone strikes, right? But for others, it's more subtle than that. It's more like mental health problems, depression, loneliness. Like there, all of these are consequences of a digital environment and the kind of the subsumption of a lot of social relations into a digital environment that's so heavily based on profiling, targeting, and manipulation, right? And sorting people into categories. So continuously sorting people into categories and breaking society down into categories. That's what happens. And so a lot of the narrative work is about drawing the lines between these things, right? So it's like now when people think about privacy, not many people think like, oh yeah, I need privacy because it's going to help me with the fatigue that I'm feeling or the mental health problems that I'm having. But like the more we start to articulate those things, the more people will start to get it. It's like, oh yeah, actually, maybe the reason why I have, you know, some of these health issues is literally because I'm bombarded through digital interfaces. I mean, you know, there's lots of things that we could go into here, but like, I guess that would be my response.
I love that you're going into consequences about privacy. I think one of the first things that came into my mind, I moved to Berlin actually during a week before COVID, the whole thing started, that whole shit show, and the toilet paper, lack of toilet paper shit show, I call it. But anyways, and like one of the first thing I did, and I think it was like a week after I came to Berlin or a week after the whole thing started, was I think I wrote an article which was consequences of privacy laws passed during that. And I think people didn't understand of the amount of anti-privacy laws that have been passed. Unfortunately, they don't see that during the last 3-4 years have been absolutely astonishingly crazy under that sauce. And like, bloop, it's like in the First World War, right? It's like, hey, now the government is going to intervene into any business whenever they want. Of course, we will remove the laws after the war is gone. No, you haven't. It's been 100 years, guys.
Yeah.
So, yeah, absolutely, absolutely agree with you. It's crazy that adaptability, that sometimes our killer feature in survival, amongst others, is sometimes killing us as well. Like getting used to those like Web 2 advertisement models, you know, like they're the only thing that could ever exist. It's like, oh, it has to be like that. I feel you. I feel you totally.
Yeah. And it's about opening up the imagination, right? It's about like, articulating for people that it doesn't have to be this way. It's not normal, right? We can do things differently.
It's crazy how people put together responsibility and privacy and lack of privacy. They kind of like, for some reason, people think if you're private, that's unresponsible to others. It's like, but why is it like, what are you talking about? What's going on here? How did it connect? But the reason, by the way, I was asking before about not validators, I didn't get to that, but I wanted to get to that because I would assume that a lot of our listeners are some to do with validation and have to do something with validation. We are validators ourselves. But I guess the Tornado Cash case, could it affect, I don't know, the people who want to validate NIM, or that is not the case in this story? Do you know what I'm getting at? Like, I could see it.
Yeah, at NIM, you know, we really try to toe the line here, right? So like we're not a kind of project that's like on some kind of kamikaze mission against all governments of the world. Legal compliance is important to us because we think that there's like a lot of different fronts to take this debate on, right? And we don't want to end up in a situation where what we're building gets shut down immediately just because we want to kind of like be loud and confrontational with governments. So, you know, we are quite careful around compliance, and we're quite careful about taking the debates and taking the confrontation in a kind of reasonable manner that doesn't put people at risk. Like that's, you know, at this stage of the project, absolutely important for us, because it's important for us that that we have the chance to realize this system. You know, I think it's possible to get to a point where like the adoption and use of the NIM mixnet becomes something that, you know, not just a few kind of like crypto wallets take advantage of, but that there's actually institutional adoption, right? So like some, you know, another piece of interesting NIM history is that actually like the technologies that are used in NIM have come out of European Commission funded R&D projects, right? So, it's not a far stretch to imagine the European Commission actually like integrating with and using the NIM Mixnet, for example. And so like for us, what we're hoping to see is a kind of wide, broad spectrum of both institutions, traditional companies, crypto companies, chat apps and everything integrating with the NIM Mixnet, exactly in order to prove the point that this is a system that is for everybody in order to protect the network layer of communications in general, right? So, and then at that point, you kind of get out of this like immediate association or kind of use only for some kind of headline crime situation that is like, you know, we're trying to kind of move away from that. So yeah, in terms of kind of like legal risk to validators, like if anyone does have any like specific concerns around that, like absolutely feel free to reach out individually. But I can say, you know, compliance is actually like pretty important for us because we want this project to survive and be real.
Absolutely. I understand what you mean. Still, I think definitely I have seen interest in privacy projects, I think, rise since the whole Tornado Cash thing happened. And I think that's the obvious response of the market, right? It's like, well, guys. But anyways, not the point, because I think, again, I would love to discuss this more, but I'm going to get to the final question because I just realized, I don't know, it always happens, Whenever you have an interesting conversation with a person, it's like, oh, and an hour is gone. We need to invent something for those extending hours in a day or something like that. Or Jaya, blitz three questions. They're not blitz as such. You feel free to answer them in a very long way, in a very short way, up to you. Three projects outside the top 20 that you are following and you think are interesting in terms of what they're developing.
Ooh, you know, you caught me in like a really tight spot because do you know what? Have you ever had when someone is like, "What's your favorite music?" and then you just go blank because you're like,
they don't have to be really favorite. You know, you could just say three interesting projects that you're following outside of the top 20 by market cap, and I hope not stable coins, but of course, feel free to say them as well.
So I don't know where Gnosis is in terms of market cap and if I'm allowed to mention Gnosis, but I actually think like Gnosis and kind of multi-sig wallets. And I know that that crew are actually, they're working on some kind of private voting system right now. So for me, I find that project to be super interesting for a variety of reasons. Like, first of all, like multi-sig wallets have turned out to be like a major tool for the whole industry and beyond, right? So it's kind of the core of most DAOs. And it's like, I think it's like as a tool, not just for people in the blockchain industry, but even beyond, is something that kind of sparks a lot of imagination. And so, you know, having multi-sig wallets that, you know, include some form of private voting, this and that, I think is like fascinating. And I think this is a project that everybody should follow and tinker with and play around with. And then, of course, I would also mention Manta because they are not just great collaborators in the Universal Privacy Alliance, but also focusing on chain privacy is like super important. One of the big kind of contradictions in blockchain is obviously that there's like people emphasize the importance of privacy, but, you know, are building, you know, public ledgers, right? And so the possibility for and the tooling for on-chain privacy, I would say, is like probably absolutely my second here. And then Secret Network as well. So opening up the design space for customizable privacy. It's another fantastic project with the super sound crew behind it. So yeah, I'd probably say Gnosis is probably like pretty major already it might not qualify for your like not so well-known project, but you know, Manta.
Anything
Secret,
goes.
Anything goes, yeah.
It's perfect. I think on our podcast, I would say that probably Secret Network is more known to the listeners than I would assume, because we did like several episodes which cover either Secret Network itself or a project built on Secret Network or somebody validates Secret Network, even though we have something with Gnosis as well. But that is for the very careful listeners to find. It's buried within 15 minutes of one episode. You have to really like go out there and find it. It's not easy, but it is with the founder, I believe, of it's one of the guys from Gnosis. Second question, sorry. Two daily things that motivate you to keep on building privacy and to keep on doing everything you do in your daily life.
Two daily things is my team at NIM, absolutely. And the NIM community, you know, when I see the NIM community kind of like posting and talking about their reasons for being involved and why they find the project important and inspiring, those are the things that keep me going. You know, it's like, I love getting DMs. I love getting people contacting me on various platforms when they're interested in what we're doing. So I would say those are the kind of feedback from the community and the motivation and work of my team. Yeah.
Last one. One person, doesn't matter dead or alive, well, it'd be hard for a dead one to follow a dead person, but one person that you recommend could be a writer, a developer, I don't know, it doesn't matter, an account or a project to follow for people that might help them, or to read the book of that might help them to succeed in life and to be happier in life.
Ooh, again, this is a tough question. I have so many favorites.
Yeah, choose anyone. It doesn't have to be your favorite. It's one that helped to change you, maybe.
Obviously, you should follow Nim, right? So Nim will change your life. Follow all the Nim accounts. And then...
One. The same.
Okay.
Good one. One. Okay.
Yeah. And then in terms of following accounts, like I find Meredith Whitaker, the new president of Signal, super inspiring. And partially because like she comes from a background in AI, right? So from someone that has moved from, you know, kind of AI and the ethics of AI with Google to privacy, it's like you suddenly realize, you know, she represents the full data pipeline, right? It's like privacy is an intervention into the kind of industry that's producing AI in deeply unethical and fucked up ways. So it opens up the imagination of what you can do if you have privacy as the default. You can actually build artificial intelligence in a way that's much more closely related to people having some decision-making over what data is inputted and stuff. So yeah, I would say those two.
That was a fascinating last answer that goes for a second, like continuation of the conversation.
Another hour, right?
I'm going to hold myself. Jaya, thank you very, 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 very much for updating us what's going on with Nim and having the time for this fascinating conversation. And I know people are busy building and you yourself probably is as well. So, and it seems like you are. So thank you for finding the time to join us.
Thank you for the invitation. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Thanks. Ciao.
This content was created by the Citizen Cosmos Validator. If you enjoyed it, please support us by delegating to Citizen Cosmos and help us to create more educational content.